All right, y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio, Chaos 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. We're also streaming, I think, still. Nah, I guess the link's dead by now because we're over time. But anyway, usually we're streaming from antiwar.com/radio, and that's where we keep the archives of all these great interviews. Another one coming up this very moment with Chris Floyd. The blog is called Empire Burlesque. It's at chris-floyd.com. Empire Burlesque is also the name of the book. And, you know, every time I read Chris's blog, it always reminds me of Garrett Garrett, because Chris always writes about the fall of the Republic, the end of America. This is it. We have blown it. They drew a line, and then they crossed it, and then they drew another one, and they crossed it again, and that's it, and our Constitution, our Republic is dead. And I think of Garrett Garrett said, "Don't look to the future for the revolution. It already passed in the night, singing songs to freedom." That was 50 years ago, 60 years ago now. All right, welcome to the show, Chris. Good to talk to you again, my friend.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
All right, so I got to tell you, your site bums me out because you see the world with such clarity, at least according to my point of view, and you write so well about it. It's oftentimes some really heartbreaking stuff, the way you force, you know, white Americans, I guess, the exceptional, to put themselves in the shoes of the people who are our government's victims around the world. And you remind people that Somalis are just people just like them, and, you know, name the country where our government's slaughtering people: Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and on like that. And that's what I really, really like about your blog is you're very succinct, and you do a lot of that other shoes kind of writing, which is sorely lacking. A perspective that I think most commentators these days can't even try out, much less, you know, put into written word form.
Well, yeah, well, thanks a lot. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's not much fun because we have to, but as you say, our reality is not much fun at this time. I guess one thing, I mean, one reason I write about a lot of this stuff is precisely because of what you said. You know, there's a huge gap. I write about it because not a lot of other people are writing about it. So I write about a lot of these things just to try to find out myself what's going on, and try to find out for myself what the implications are of the little nuggets of fact that you can draw. You know, you can get a little fact here and a little fact there from mainstream media. And there are some really good reporters, as I've mentioned on my blog this week, Carlotta Gall, who's in Afghanistan. So you can pull some facts from the mainstream media, but then you have to, you know, and try to put aside all the spin that they put on it. And then what you have to try to do, or what I try to do, is just try to say, well, what does this mean? What's actually happening? And also, I guess the main thing I'm trying to do is that what is really happening? You know, let's just call it in the words to describe the reality. It's like Confucius said, you know, what did he said, how do you reform the state? You first have to rectify the language. You have to call things by their right name. You have to call an atrocity, not, an unfortunate instance. And you have to call torture, and not rigorous interrogation. You know, you have to call mass murder when, as we saw last week, 90 civilians are wiped out in a small village in Afghanistan. I mean, that's the main point, is that, and I guess the reason, as I say, the reason I keep doing it is because there's just not a lot of that. Of course, you know, there's all kinds of blogs and people that write and do it much better than I, but I just, you know, for myself, that's what I'm trying to do. And if you try to look at what's going on out there, if you use that phrase that the Bush people love, you know, what unvarnished truth or unvarnished advice, whatever it is, unvarnished. If you try to peel off the varnish and try to step outside the media bubble where assumptions aren't even questioned, you know, I mean, you don't even question it. It's like, why are we in Afghanistan? We don't even question it. It's the good war. We don't even think about it. Well, you have to step back and think about these things. And, of course, as I say, other people are doing it. I mean, Ted Rawl has been excellent on Afghanistan from the very word go, you know, and quite forthright. And he actually does have a mainstream media presence. He has a column, a syndicated column. So there are people out there. But anyway, that's sort of what's going on at our place.
Yeah, well, I think that's really important when you focus on the manipulation of language. You know, I think I must have been 14 or something when I saw George Carlin do his bit about euphemisms and how we call toilet paper, bathroom tissue, and partly cloudy, partly sunny, and motels became motor lodges, and shell shock became post-traumatic stress disorder, 8 syllables and a hyphen. and all that kind of thing. And that's something that I notice so often, the manipulation of language and in fact, even sort of the abandonment of argument for just slogans. And, you know, a slogan is, I guess it's okay if you know that there's this whole other, you know, at least paragraph worth of explanation that it stands for or something. But we live in a world where the surge has worked, and it just worked, okay? That's it. There's no argument behind it. It's simply a slogan. That's good enough. Nobody even knows what worked means.
Well, absolutely, of course. I mean, you've seized on, you know, one of the most salient points going today is the surge has worked, and it's become, as you say, overwhelmingly adopted as the conventional wisdom, as one of those assumptions that aren't questioned. But as you know, it is, linguistically, it's a meaningless sentence. It doesn't mean the surge has worked. What does it mean? Has it worked? And what is your evidence that the surge has worked? Well, you know, I've written about this before, and Juan Cole recently wrote a very good piece on how the surge has not worked at all, and how what this so-called reduction in violence in Iraq has simply, you know, ratcheted down the violence from just an unimaginably hellish level to the level of some of the worst civic conflicts in the last 100 years, Lebanon and Sri Lanka and these places that, you know, Lebanon during the 70s, during the Civil War in the 70s and the 80s, and Sri Lanka today and all these places, which, you know, were considered or are considered living hell. This is the reality of the success of the surge. But no, it's absolutely, I mean, this is, as you say, the manipulation of language and the use of language that insulates people from reality is very important. As again, I'll come back to your example, the surge is a success. This has had a tremendous effect. This meme, this slogan, this lie has had a tremendous effect, as we can see, on the American political campaign in the last year, because it's totally taken Iraq off the table. The Democrats don't want to talk about Iraq. They don't want to talk, I mean, they never want to talk about Iraq anyway, because what can they say? I mean, their plan is essentially, Obama's plan is essentially the same plan as McCain and Bush's. You know, we're going to withdraw combat troops at some point in the near future, you know, dependent on the circumstances on the ground. And we're going to leave behind a residual force to do A, B, C, D. But anyway, so the Democrats is taking it off the table as an issue. Just put it away because, well, it's a success. We don't want to talk about it. As I wrote earlier this week, Obama was on television last week on Fox TV, Fox News, talking about the surge as wildly successful, successful beyond our wildest dreams. Well, I mean, this is just, I think Arthur Silva has written about this just today, about Democrats, you know, reverting to their old tradition of giving the game away. I mean, if you come on and you say, well, the surge has been a great success, you've just handed the surge in Iraq had been McCain's, you know, signature issue. I backed the surge and the surge of success. You just handed him, you know, you just given up, you've handed your sword to the enemy. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But as I say, that's what I mean. This manipulation of language, this surge bit has been, you know, a masterstroke. You know, I've done this, I've said this before. I don't know if Bush, whoever Bush is controlling, you know, Rove, all these people are sometimes underestimated because they can't govern. You know, Bush can't govern. The Bush administration, they can't govern. The Bush faction, they can't govern a country. They have no interest in governing a country. They have no interest in preserving a republic. They have no interest in doing any of that kind of stuff. But at politics, they're very, very good at maintaining power and at manipulating a message. And this thing about the surge has just been a masterstroke politically. And, of course, but it all ties into a larger thing. One reason it's a masterstroke politically is that because the mainstream media has sort of abandoned Iraq, and they had to abandon Iraq because it's such a hellhole to be there. It's not safe. You know, it's not safe for their reporters. There's no, you know, I was talking with someone last night. I think I was telling my oldest daughter, I was talking about television coverage of Vietnam, the Vietnam War. She's 22. You know, we were talking about the contrast between the Vietnam War and what's going on now. And I was very cognizant of what's going on in Vietnam. I was just, if it had gone on another year or two, I would have been up for the draft, though. You had reporters. Of course, there was some control, but they were ranging all over Vietnam. You know, if they could get to a base, they could see what happened. I recall seeing stories where this is, you know, well, the Pentagon tonight said, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so having a Khe Sanh, but here at Khe Sanh, I can tell you that, you know, that it wasn't that way. Well, there's nothing, absolutely nothing remotely like that, and never has been like that in Iraq. And so, as a young child, basically, growing up, I saw this stuff about Vietnam. It was like an introduction to the way the world really is and what's going on. But what about these generations that's grown up from the first Gulf War to now, where all the wars are insulated behind these slogans, the war on terror, the war of Iraqi freedom, you know, the surge is successful. They're insulated behind slogans. They're insulated behind, you know, this absolute Soviet-like control of the media, what gets out on the battlefront. And so, you eliminate the media that way, first of all, by not letting them go in some places and also making it so dangerous that they can't be there. And, of course, you can report that the surge is a success. I mean, who's going to gainsay, you know? I mean, of course, yeah, antiwar.com will find the stories here and there, will pick out the stories here and there in the world, you know, from people like Patrick Coburn and things like that. I mean, you know, Darja Mail and people like that, you can find them. But, you know, in the broad sense, where are you going to find this sort of thing? It's not out there. Where is the 13-year-old boy watching television going to find out this kind of thing? He's not going to find out about it, you know. And so, so it's been a masterstroke, and it's taken the very thing that put Obama into national prominence was the fact that he was considered, and, you know, we should emphasize that, he was considered an anti-war candidate. And this is what brought him to national prominence. This was the main thing, the selling point against him, against Hillary Clinton, was, well, she voted for the war. What can you say? The point is that that issue is gone, and Obama himself has given it away, of course, because his plan is calls for a continuation of the war. And now he's given away the surge because he's accepted this conventional wisdom. It's been a masterstroke, and it's been a disaster, because I've also mentioned, and I don't mean to go on about this, but I mentioned earlier this week when they talked about the success of the surge, and I wrote somewhere that, yes, surge has been a success in the same way that what Albert Speer did during World War II. As you know, he was the head of Hitler's armaments from 1943 to 1945, and he worked miracles at keeping the German war machine going when it should, by all rights, should have collapsed. You know, he kept the German economy going, he kept the war machine going, production going. Yes, that was a great success, and what did it do? It, you know, prolonged the war by two more years. Millions and millions of people died, and those were also the years of the height of the Holocaust. Well, but it was a success, wasn't it? He did what he had to do. And the surge, too, has done the same thing. It has prolonged the war. It has prolonged our involvement in the war. And in that terms, it is a success. But in any other conceivable measure, especially, and I know this is quite naive to think about the human measurement of all the thousands and thousands of people who have died, and the hundreds of Americans have died since that time. You know, it's a gigantic, catastrophic failure of the human spirit, if you want to call it that. You know, it's been a triumph of ethnic cleansing, a triumph of corruption, a triumph of creating new militias that will be fighting later on. You know, these Sunni militias, these Sons of Iraq, the awakening movement. You know, what they've done there is just created another, just as they did Al Qaeda back in the first go round in Afghanistan. You know, this is another army of ethnic extremists that will be coming back to bite us in the tail later on. So, I mean, this. Yeah, it's a success like Speer's war machine, Nazi war machine, was a success. So, but it's off the table, right? No one's talking about it, and here we are.
Well, you know, as far as the disappointment about Obama, and I know you never suffered any illusions, but as far as all the people who thought that this guy was a peace candidate, these people who are getting the Sarah Palin style glasses and all getting their hair done like Sarah Palin now and falling for all this sloganeering on the right, the Democrats who fell for this Barack Obama scam are no different whatsoever. It all comes down to a bunch of slogans. In fact, you think about these guys, change, experience, one-word slogans, a syllable here, three syllables there. And you know what? For the first time, I think, ever in American history, there was actually somebody running for president who really did want to restore the republic, who didn't even want to be president, who really did want to end the war, and it was Ron Paul. And they all told him, go to hell, you must hate queers or something, we don't like you, we believe in Obama. And he lost.
Well, this is an excellent point you made. It's an excellent point you made about the, we're down to one-word slogans now. Chicken in every pot, at least that had five or six, seven words in it.
Right.
Yes, it's change, reform, hope. But, you know, absolutely right. I mean, I didn't have any illusions about Obama. But I suppose in the early days, one could have hoped that he would have just simply adopted several positions just, you know, to get elected, because these are popular positions, you know, restoring the republic, restoring the rule of law. If you run on these positions, they're fairly popular in a lot of ways, if you could get your message out. But, yes, you're right. Another thing you were right about, too, comparing Obama to Palin, is this is where the Democrats, you know, if you live by celebrity, you die by celebrity. And one thing that Obama was, they emptied out sort of the substance of anything that was in Obama's campaign, and they made it all about him, his story, the personality, you know, his remarkable story. It is a remarkable story. Yes, of course it is. But they made it all about the story, the narrative. And so now, you know, this is what they based their campaign on. And now here come the Republicans. They found someone with a narrative, too. You know, all of this is meaningless. All of this is meaningless against the backdrop of, you know, a million people dead in Iraq, you know, in the name of America. That's what's happening. A million people. That's a a massive sort of genocidal frenzy that's been going on, you know, in the name of America with bipartisan support. That's the background of all this. But if you're going to run a campaign and you run it based on this emptiness, well, then of course you're getting knocked off by someone else's narrative. I mean, it's just to get back to the horse race aspect, which I really hate, you know, in a lot of ways to talk about, you know, the campaign, you know, who's ahead, who's behind. But it's just the Democrats are just running this, you know. It's, I think I mentioned the other day, you know, that referring to Obama as the new Dukakis, you know, they just run these campaigns over and over again. And it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's funny, the new Dukakis. That's actually a really good one. And, didn't he lose spectacularly? That's right. Boy, I'll tell you.
Yeah, to a Bush.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I have a lot of trouble preferring Obama to McCain at all until I just look at the depths of evil in McCain. I just think he's probably the most dangerous man in the world, and probably I think only John McCain could make Barack Obama look good at this point. But, you know, let's forget all this stupid election thing. Let's talk about something real, man. There's a new Cold War going on here. And I know that after the Cold War ended, maybe before that, you were a reporter. You wrote for the Moscow Times, which isn't Pravda. You wrote for the Moscow Times. I know you lived in Russia for quite a while there. And you see NATO expansion to Russia's doorstep in Poland, in the Czech Republic soon. Apparently, all factions agree. Again, you can lump Obama in with Cheney and McCain and Palin and everyone else that they want to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO as well. And obviously, the conflict over South Ossetia a month ago and all this stuff. What the hell is going on here? Is there any real reason why we need to have a conflict with Russia? And what is behind this, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. I mean, there's a lot of things behind it. I mean, there's no reason to have this kind of conflict. I mean, there's no reason to have this. No, there's no reason to have this swords drawn kind of conflict with Russia. I mean, there's plenty of good reasons if you want to operate permanent war machine that we have. You know, if you want to perpetuate the national security state, as Gore Vidal talks about, that we've had since 1947 or so. If you want to perpetuate that, you know, if you want to perpetuate the House of War, as James Carroll wrote in his wonderful book about the Pentagon, which has militarized our economy and militarized our society. Now, if you want to perpetuate that, well, then, yes, there's, you know, you get a lot of good mileage out of
conflict.
No,
I said good reasons.
Good reasons. Now, well, okay. Well, I mean, these are good reasons for a lot of people. That's what I mean. These are the reasons why you would fuel this sort of thing. And of course, Russia has great energy resources now, and they have dominion, you know, domination over other pipelines and things like that. But no, of course, it's a ridiculous thing to do. And this thing about fast-tracking Georgia into NATO is just, is a remarkably insane strategy to pursue. Because, as Sarah Palin noted in her interview this week, that, you know, well, good, you know, if, Georgia decides to jab Russia again, we might all be involved in a world war with them. Because, yes, she said, well, we might have to go to war with them. Because if they're in NATO and they get into a war, we'll have to back them. And, again, all this can be, no one wants to apologize or be an apologist for, Putin and that regime and the Russian regime. Although, at the same time, you don't want to demonize them the way that they are demonized so handily in the press. But, no, of course, these are people that, it just kind of boggles my mind. It's a huge power. They're a very strong power. They're a superpower. They've got nuclear missiles that they could aim at us and wipe us out at any time, you know, or kill hundreds of millions of people. You have to treat them seriously. You have to take them seriously. You can't treat them as if they're a Venezuela, like we're trying to do now, you know, and accuse their ministers of being terrorist supporters, as Bush has done today with Venezuela. But you can't treat them like these kind of countries. You have to treat them as a serious country with serious concerns, and this is exactly what they're not doing.
Well, I want to know more about this guy Putin and what you can tell me about him. God help me, I saw Henry Kissinger on TV say, listen, if this guy Vladimir Putin is making himself the dictator of Russia, stepping down from the presidency when he could have simply amended the Constitution and run again and won handily, and becoming prime minister sure is a strange route to take, and we ought to not be pushing this conflict. And boy, are things really that bad that Henry Kissinger's the voice of reason in the imperial court in Washington, D.C.?
Of course, Kissinger is a vile war criminal in very many respects. But he's always been somewhat of a voice of reason in some respects, especially remember he was the architect of detente back in the old days. So, you know, Kissinger does have this experience in that he has dealt with the Soviet Union, the real Soviet Union. And he's dealt with real Soviet dictators, as, you know, a lot of people have. And it's sort of like that Dan Quayle moment, you know, Vladimir Putin, you are no Soviet leader, you see. I mean, what we have now, Russia is not a paradise on earth or anything like that. But what you're dealing with, if you compare it to the Soviet Union, if you compare it to the threat of the Soviet Union, if you compare it to the aggression of the Soviet Union, if you compare it to the you know, ambitions of the Soviet Union, if you compare it to the internal, especially the internal situation that the people themselves lived in the Soviet Union, it's there is no comparison. I mean, it boggles the mind. What are you talking about? And here you have 15 years ago, this vast empire, ideological empire based on repression and controlling hundreds of millions of people outside of Russia's borders with nuclear weapons aimed at the United States and other Western nations. And this is what you had 15 years ago. And now what do you have? You have a regime that's a partner in a lot of things with the West. Doesn't have any sort of comparison to what you were facing before. And so, but of course, they've just sort of ratcheted up the same Cold War rhetoric. Because who are these guys doing? I mean, it's Cheney. It's the Bushes. It's these guys have been around for 40, 30 years. This is what they do. This is what they know. And of course, now that you have the energy equation into all of it, it makes it a real conflict. Before, you know, the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union was ideological. And in some ways, that's sort of the best way to be, you know, because, like, we weren't really dicing with the Soviets on any over resources and things like that, you know. I mean, the Soviet Union didn't really affect any bottom lines in the American power structure, you know, and big business, you know, because it was a completely closed economy anyway, right? We can't make any money out of that. That's just closed off, you know, so we went on like that. But now, you see, Russia threatens the bottom line of a lot of big corporations. They threaten the bottom line of the energy, you know, even threaten the bottom line. I mean, they want to be a big player in the energy market, you know. So suddenly they are, you know, completely evil, and we're back to the Cold War again. But in some ways it's more serious now because there's money on the line. You see, before there wasn't that much money on the line, except for maybe a, you know, Pepsi Cola plant in the Soviet Union back in the 70s. But, you know, now there's real money, there's oil on the line, and that's why it's even more serious. You know, these guys will go to war with that. I don't think they've ever gone to war, but ideology, you know, they wouldn't have attacked Russia because they were communists, you know, eating their babies or anything like that. They don't care about that. You know, they obviously don't care about that. But if Russia threatens, you know, the playground of the oil companies, well, that's some serious stuff, you see.
Well, now, Sarah Palin wasn't doing anything but being honest, unlike John McCain and Dick Cheney and the rest of them. She said frankly to Charles Gibson, yes, see, the way it works, Charles, is that NATO membership is a war guarantee. That means, yes, we'll have a war with Russia if they invade NATO once they join. Don't you understand that? Which says only that she's so stupid that she doesn't know she's not supposed to say that. Other than that, she actually got it right.
Well,
yay.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah.
I can admit that in the children's sense, not the sexist sense, but because I was thinking of the biblical quotation. But I thought NATO was supposed to be an alliance for peace. That's what we've been told all these last 50 years. I didn't know it was a war trigger, but yes, of course, you know, you will often find newcomers being a little too forthright about what's actually going on. But
well, what do you mean? NATO membership isn't a war guarantee?
No, it's all about peace, isn't it? Don't you think it's about peace? That's why they're...
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I remember that's what it said on the brochure and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. It's just making sure I got you there, the difference between the narrative and the truth.
Yeah, what's
yeah.
that?
All right, now, tell me this. I'm just taking a shot in the dark, but I'm willing to bet that you know all about Joe Biden. What do you think of him, Barack Obama's running mate?
You know, I thought when I saw Joe Biden became the vice presidential nominee, I thought, well, this is it. We've really made it. We're on top now. I mean, you know, this is the... paradise on earth. No, actually, I wrote in my blog, I was on vacation at the time. I was at the place where they didn't speak the language, but happened just, it was like one of the very few times I had a chance to sit down and see 20 minutes of CNN, see what was going on in the world. I hadn't heard anything that was going on in the world for about 5 or 6 days, which was quite blissful considering the way the world is these days. But I turned on the television, and there was Obama, there was Joe Biden, and I just like burst out laughing. I said, you have got to be kidding. It's like the absolute, again, from this horse race aspect, it's like the worst pick you could possibly imagine, except for possible exception of Joe Lieberman. I just couldn't, you know, here's this old, white, corporate, courtesan, I don't want to say, boneheaded sort of goober you know, and the reason, only reason he's fit because he's old and white and he's sort of bellicose, you know. I mean, it's just, and on top of that, if you're going to talk about a horse race aspect, on top of that, he comes from one of the smallest states in the whole country. You know, I mean, they couldn't find some old, white, bellicose goober from California or something, or some swing state. I mean, it's just, I mean, I just couldn't believe it. And I wrote about it in my column, of course, in my blog. I've been against Biden for years, especially because of the bankruptcy bill. You know, I know you know about the bankruptcy bill, which was one of the most, as I've said before, one of the most draconian weapons used in the last quarter century in the class war, you know, that's being waged against working people and the poor in the country.
Why don't you elaborate on that? Tell us about what you mean.
Well, I mean, the bankruptcy law was written by the, it was a law that they tried to get passed for years and years and years and years, and it was always defeated at the last minute, but it was a law written basically by, it was written by the credit card companies and the financial services industry to favor the financial services industry and make the already strict bankruptcy laws in America. And I can tell you, they're pretty strict, even in the old days when they were supposedly so lenient. And just really tightened them and made sure that in most cases, or in many bankruptcies, one of the provisions was, in many bankruptcies, that the credit card companies would get paid first before anybody else, you see. If you had to go into, you know, had into liquidation, if you had to go declare yourself bankrupt, the credit card companies are going to get their money, you know, up front. Even sometimes before child support, or before, you know, medical insurance. This kind of thing like this just made it much harder to declare bankruptcy, much harder to write off any debts. I mean, I don't have all the details in front of me now. But, and Biden, of course, comes from Delaware, where a lot of these credit card companies are incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just, I mean, he's their bagman. He's their boy. He's always been, he's the senator from MNBA or whatever the big credit card company is up there.
Well, and you know, they always completely ignore the responsibility of the government and the banks working together to inflate the currency with their low reserve ratios and their artificially low interest rates, where they basically lure all these regular people deep into debt, and then they go, ah, sorry, and then they wage a war against the inflation they cause and raise the interest rates, screw everybody, force them into bankruptcy, and then they get to collect all their property for pennies on the dollar.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wrote about this years ago about, well, you know, what the bankruptcy law did. So that was a key point. When it first came up, or when I first wrote about it, it was 2003. And that was the main point, was that it was the credit card companies themselves and the banks who lured the most vulnerable people in society, you know, as you say, with cheap credit, no interest rates. You know, they targeted the old, they targeted the young people just starting out, they targeted the sick, you know. There was, you know, of course you were going to take cheap credit. I can't get money here. You want money? Here's $1,000. Here's $2,000. And the next thing you know, then they pull it in. Yes, of course. I mean, it was the government and the corporate policies to create all this debt. And then it was, when the crunch time came, the Senate and Joe Biden leading the way, you know, stood up to protect these predators. Joe Biden was, I wrote him off for that a long time ago. You know, he's very bellicose. He's very,
Well, he's one of the guys who went straight to Georgia and said, we're all Georgians now, like,
oh,
John,
yes,
McCain.
He was the guy that, yes, Obama sent over to Georgia, and let's fast track and let's go to war against these Ruskies and all this sort of thing. I mean, it's just, he's got a whole long history, not only of campaign gaffes. You know, he had to quit one president's race because he plagiarized a British leader's speech and all this sort of stuff. I mean, he just came ready-made with all kinds of things that you could, again, from the horse race aspect, that you could just nitpick him to death, you know.
Yeah. Well,
and I think it was, here's another revealing thing that the pick showed, was that I think he was picked specifically because of that flurry that came during the Russia-Georgia conflict, you know. I think he was picked specifically to handle that one issue, which shows, you know, a complete lack of vision, much less a, you know, dream of hope and change in Obama, because they said, oh, you know, we look bad. There's this Georgia-Russia thing. There's a lot of bad press going on about that, you know, and we better get someone who's really tough and bellicose and white and is in the power structure and get him in here right away. But of course, you know, that the Russia-Georgia thing is already sort of dropped off the radar now. It was always going to be, I mean, it's not dropped off the radar of the Beltway people, but people out there in the general public, you know, that's something they've already moved on. So it was like a panic decision. You know, I guess, you know, it was a panic decision. And, it was just, the last confirmation, of course, Obama's been showing this over and over and over again from his vote for the FISA law, you know, his vote for warrantless wiretapping and surveillance of the American people and to immunize vast, huge corporations for taking part in blatantly illegal operations, you know, for the FISA and the spying on American people. From that vote to his positions on Iran, his positions on Iraq, But this was the final confirmation that he was, you know, that all you're going to get from Obama and Biden is just the same old thing. You know, it's just, I mean, there's nothing new. There's no reform. There's no hope. You just get two more guys that are going to serve this militaristic empire-building, constitution-gutting system that we have. And, you know, that's all. That's what you're going to get from. That's what it is. That, you know, it's just Dukakis and Benson, it's just the same old thing, you know, with Kerry and whoever Kerry ran with, Edwards, can't even remember these days. But, you know, I mean...
He's pretty forgettable.
They're all for the war on terror, and they're all for the, you know, they're for expanding the war to Pakistan, which is what we see now is happening. And it's just, as you say, even if you don't have any illusions about Obama's Democrats, it's still dispiriting. It's still a despairing thing to see, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if we have time, I'd like to get back to Pakistan. But right now I want to focus on one issue that all of these candidates, all four of them, I'm sure someone will instruct Palin on her Africa positions, you know, sometime this week. But the rest of them all already agree on the record that America needs to expand our intervention in Africa. And, of course, this is a topic, something that you've written about and that's caused, I think, quite a bit of controversy. You dare to assert, sir, that Somalis are human beings and it's wrong for Americans to have them slaughtered en masse. How can you possibly defend that position?
Oh, well, you know, I was just drunk at the time. No, I know. Well, this, now I've come on here and talked about Somalia before. Now you've had some other people talking about it. It's a remarkable situation. It's a remarkable situation. America's a direct involvement and long-running involvement in what is now regarded as the worst humanitarian disaster in the world today. And you've got tens of thousands killed. You've got millions dispossessed in Somalia. It's a very small country anyway in terms of population. And America's been directly involved. They've been directly. We trained. We funded the Ethiopian army that invaded Somalia along with some, you know, favored CIA warlords, some of them directly in the pay of the CIA. And they've essentially used Ethiopia as a proxy army to carry out the same sort of regime change that we've seen in Iraq with the same sort of results. You know, a completely ineffective central government installed at the point of foreign guns, radicalizing the population, empowering extremists, and bringing a nation that was already crumbling to a state of complete ruin. I mean, it's just unconscionable. It's almost unspeakable. And we, you know, America took part in it, not only trained and funded Ethiopia, or we used bombing runs in the initial attack. We bombed refugees. We bombed herdsmen. We captured refugees and renditioned them back to Ethiopia where they have torture chambers and things like that. And also, as was noted in, I can't remember if it's in Vanity Fair or Esquire, one ran a big article about this Africa command. We used death squads. We sent in death squads to mop up after our covert operations. And this was just openly admitted. You know, we had a certain unit. I don't have the unit in front of me right now. A certain unit would come in after these air strikes or missile strikes at alleged terrorists. And we know how many, you know, how much collateral damage gets done to these things. And they would go in and mop up. So we run death squads in Somalia. And all this is just straight out in the open if you want to look.
To kill the witnesses, you're saying?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, to clean up afterwards. And, I mean, it's just
to clean up afterwards. That's what they call it, cleaning up afterwards.
Well, yeah, it's a mop up operation. But as you said, no one talks about this. It's not talked about. None of the candidates have any position on it. Even Barack Obama, whose own father was a black African Muslim, like the ones being killed in Somalia right now, has nothing to say about it. He has nothing to say about it. No one has anything to say about it. It's just a remarkable state of affairs, and it goes on and on, and it's a deep stain on our national honor, if there's any room for any more stains on there.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess you can. That's the thing with stains, and you can kind of pile them up on top of each other. There's another one coming soon. It's in North Africa. John McCain, I know, is determined to put American combat forces on the ground in Sudan. And Barack Obama, hell, he went to Germany. He went to Berlin. He assembled the biggest crowd there probably since Hitler or something, or, you know, some East German roundup or something. And he proclaimed never again and cited the Sudan. So, you know, you might as well sign your kids up now. It's on, man. This terror war is going to be spread all across, you know, Muslim Northern Africa.
Well, you know, in the very first days after the world changed on 9/11, Cheney or Bush came out to say, I can't remember which one it was, you know, that there were 50 or 60 nations who are possible targets for some sort of action in this war on terror. 50 or 60 nations were, you know, possible targets. So I suppose these were supposed to be nations where some terrorist activity was being, someone was talking about it, or someone was reading the wrong book or something. But anyway, you have, so, I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, there's no end to the nations that will be part of this. And as Sudan, and as you mentioned before, there's Pakistan, which is, we're just about to get into a war in Pakistan. This, you know, that could make the Vietnam War look like Sunday picnic or something like that. It's just ridiculous. I mean, imagine the Vietnam War with nuclear weapons on the other side. It's just, you know, boggles the mind. You've got Afghanistan, you've got Pakistan, you've got Iraq, you've got Russia. They want to get into, you know, a tussle with Russia, pressure Russia, gold Russia. You've got Iran, which is still waiting out there, you know, for a nice big hit with the Israelis talking about it more and more. Now you've got Venezuela, which they're, you know, ratcheting up the pressure on. Just today, condemning two of the ministers down there as being narco-terrorists. As you well know, it's accepted doctrine now, not only by the Bush administration, but by all American leaders now, is that if someone is a terrorist or involved in a terrorist organization, then you can launch a military operation against that nation anytime you want to. I mean, it's just accepted practice now. And to call someone a terrorist means you are marking a big target on their back and saying, yes, we can hit you anytime we want to, even by our own right, you know, by our own logic. And these are just a few of the countries, you know. There is, as you say, there is no end to it. And it's a bleak time, I must say.
Yeah. All right, now, Pakistan is probably the biggest worry in the world, although I don't know that it gets all the proper attention that it deserves, probably for a lack of people who, you know, actually know what they're talking about when it comes to this thing. The war is spreading. I mean, what did I read? The headline on antiwar.com, Jason Ditz compiled a great collection of articles all about Pakistan and how they're talking about, we're going to have to retaliate. We can't just keep doing this. Our whole country is going to fall apart from the inside if we continue to let you attack inside our country like this. And Bush continues to give the military permission to strike inside Pakistan. They say they killed an Al-Qaeda leader here or there, but we know they're killing civilians en masse.
Well, of course, I know. I mean, this is, as you say, he's already given the green light for ground troops to go into Pakistan, which is the exact same way that the Vietnam War began, you know, with special forces and covert operations going into the country like that. But I mean, it's just, you know, it boggles the mind. Of course, the Pakistanis are going to have to retaliate in some way, or be seen to be try to retaliate, because what would America do if Mexico decided to make incursions into, say, Texas and New Mexico to attack, I don't know, gun dealers who are selling guns to the gangs down there? You say, okay, we're going to go, you know, you guys are supplying our gangs down here. We're going to launch an air raid on Tucson. What would they do about that? What would the United States do with, you know, incursions across our border that way? Well, it would be a cause for war. And what politician, what leader, what president could possibly stand, you know, and hold his office if he didn't strike back against that sort of thing? And so if you just said, oh, well, I guess we just have the Mexicans, you know, attack us anytime we want to, what can we do? But again, we have another situation where the United States is allowed to do anything it wants to, where other countries cannot react in the same way that the United States would react if its own sovereignty was violated that way, if its own people were killed in that way. But no, this is an incredibly dangerous sort of thing, and it just, but you know, I don't know, it becomes a point, what can you say? For years and years in my columns and blog, and many others have been writing, you know, a new situation comes up. This is a very dangerous situation. It's going to lead to a disaster. And it happens. Another situation. This is a very dangerous situation. It's going to lead to a disaster. It happens, too. And so we just keep saying this over and over again, but we just keep walking into these disasters. And
sure,
I don't know.
Sure, the surge is working. Be quiet. The surge is working.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I forgot about that.
And not only that, but also the surge is working. The surge already worked, and it's still working, and we're going to have victory. And victory, that's better than a one-syllable word, and so that sounds extra smart and must be true, even more true than surge, work.
Well, I think the slogan has just come down to surge. Just say that with an exclamation point. Surge. That's just it, you know.
Yeah.
I think it covers the whole thing.
Yeah, I actually made a bumper sticker. It says, the surge is working on you.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good.
Which is, of course, what the whole thing's about, right? It's just, give us another 6 months, give us another 6 months, give us another 6 months. Now it's almost the fall of 2008, and we'll just give them, I don't know, another 106 months, and everything will be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure. It'll all come out in the wash one of these days.
Yeah, we will have victory after a certain point of time,
yep.
As the the guy I debated last night asserted. After a point of time passes, then the goodness will come. I guess we can measure it when there's a Disneyland in Baghdad. That, I don't know, do they still use that? That used to be the measure of our success back in the early days, right?
Yeah, a bit Disneyland, McDonald's, that sort of thing is always a good measure of success.
That would be the proof that we had won their hearts and minds, the people whose lives we hadn't taken yet. I mean,
of course, if you reduce the population, it gives you a better chance to win their hearts and minds because there's fewer people that you have to win over that way.
Yeah, yeah, it's good for casualty rates, too, when 5 million people have fled the country
and are
refugees. You don't have to count the murders and starvation in the refugee camps because those take place in other countries.
Well, that's one of the reasons, of course, for the success of the surge is that millions have fled Iraq. And the ethnic cleansing of places like Baghdad is pretty much effectively over. You know, they've walled it off into these ghettos of ethnic and sectarian sections. And I mean, that's why the violence has reduced because they've killed so many people, and they've got and the different factions have got what they wanted.
Afraid so. All right. Well, on the road to hell, you can help to keep score. And one of your best sources for staying up on what's really going on as America dies is Empire Burlesque, the blog of Chris Floyd. It's available at chris-floyd.com. Thanks so much for your time on the show today, Chris.
All right, thank you.